You know, with coming up on 180 episodes in the bank and archived on the internet, you'd think by now the far middle would be scraping a diminishing inventory of worthy sports dedications. I certainly thought that would have been the case when we started this happy space, but I was wrong again. Oh, in case you're wondering, Nick DeOlius here, and welcome to the far middle. Yeah, it consistently amazes me how many legendary and deserving dedication subjects are still out there in the world of sport. And this week we have one, 179 installments into the far middle. They had to check the archive for because I couldn't believe we didn't highlight him in the past. His nickname summed up him quite well, Concrete Charlie. I'm guessing all my friends from the other side of the Keystone State might now know who I am speaking of because he was the greatest Philadelphia Eagle of all time, in my humble but informed opinion. Now, was that humble to just say that? Or was that an oxymoron or a contradiction? Well, anyway, we are dedicating episode 179 to the one and only Chuck Bednarik. And wait till you hear his life story, and then, of course, what he did as a player. Bednarik's family history and upbringing, it was the stuff of classic American dream. Born in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania in 1925, he grew up in the Depression. His parents had emigrated from Slovakia, and his dad came to Bethlehem like so many European immigrants and what they came to America for, which was to work in the mines and in the mills. His dad worked for Bethlehem Steel. Chuck attended grade school at a Slovak parochial school in Bethlehem, and classes were taught in Slovak. He then went to a public high school where he played football. Now, this guy was part of the greatest generation, and we call them that for a reason. Meaning, following graduation from high school, Bednarik entered the armed forces during World War II, 18 years old, and he saw extensive active combat when he served as a B-24 bomber waste gunner in the famous 8th Air Force. During World War II, he flew on 30 combat missions over Nazi Germany. He was awarded the Air Medal, 4 Oak Leaf Clusters, the European African Middle Eastern Campaign Medal, and 4 Battle Stars for his military service. He made a pact during his service in World War II with God. During that war, and he said, God, I'll promise you, if you get me out of this and bring me home alive, I'll go to Mass every single day for the rest of my life. And he made good on that promise for, indeed, the rest of his life. Yeah, that generation, kids of working poor immigrants or factory workers or farmers, growing up in the Depression and then fighting in World War II as young adults, this country owes them so much, and I fear we aren't living up to their legacy. Anyway, following World War II, Bednarik was able to get back to normal life, which for him meant college and football. He attended Penn on the GI Bill, where he was a 60-minute man, basically excelling as both center and linebacker on both sides of the ball, and sometimes even as a punter. So you talk about versatile. And at Penn, Bednarik was a 3-time All-American, was perhaps the best center in college football history up to that time. In fact, in 1969, he was voted by a panel of sports writers and coaches and College Football Hall of Fame players as the greatest center of all time. That was almost up until the 70s. And today, the Chuck Bednarik Award goes to the best college football defensive player, which, as we will see, was the side of the football that he played on as a pro and really excelled at and made his name as. Bednarik was the first player selected in the 1949 NFL draft, and he didn't have to move very far because the Philadelphia Eagles chose him close by to where he played school, same city. And he started on both offense as a center and on defense as a linebacker for the Eagles. He made his name, of course, as a pro, as a linebacker, and he hit like his nickname implied, as if he were made of concrete. Bednarik was a member of 2 Eagles NFL championship teams in 1949 and again in 1960, and he gained his second taste of notoriety in the final play of the 1960 NFL championship game. Bednarik was the last Eagle defensive player between the Green Bay Packers Hall of Famer Jim Taylor, who was a running back, and the end zone. And Bednarik tackled Taylor at the Eagles' 8-yard line, and he remained atop Taylor as the final seconds ticked off the clock, which ensured that the Packers couldn't run another play, and it sort of saved the Eagles' victory 17-13 and got them that 1960 NFL championship. Now, the controversy surrounding this play led the NFL to put in a rule penalizing defensive players for not allowing an offensive player to get up off the field. That's a rule that exists to this day, sort of the Bednarik rule. Now, I just stated, if you were paying attention, that was his second taste of notoriety. His first taste came about a month prior to that championship game, and it was the one he is most famous for. Late November, November 20th, 1960, game between the Eagles and the New York Giants at the original Yankee Stadium. Bednarik knocks Giants running back and another Hall of Famer in episode 117, dedication subject Frank Gifford, out of football for over 18 months in one of the most infamous tackles in NFL history, known as simply the hit. And Bednarik's clothesline tackle of Gifford dropped Gifford immediately, rendered him unconscious. Gifford was put on a stretcher, taken to a hospital, and he was diagnosed with a very serious concussion. There's a Sports Illustrated photo, I don't know if you've ever seen it, you can check it out online, of Bednarik standing over an unconscious Gifford, and that's become an iconic photo. It sort of shows Bednarik in mid-celebration right above Gifford as he lays unconscious on the field. And Bednarik defended himself by saying that he wasn't celebrating the injury to Gifford as much as he was celebrating the fumble that was caused by the hit, which the Eagles recovered, and it clinched the victory for the Eagles, again, sending the team to the 1960 NFL championship game, where he gained that second taste of notoriety that I just mentioned. Now, that play has been called one of the most iconic plays in NFL history. I had a chance to meet Bednarik years ago. He signed a copy of that photo for me. It hangs on my wall at home. And my experience with him, meeting him, Chuck Bednarik, was a great person. He was the last of the NFL's 60-minute men, players who played both offense and defense on a regular basis. And by the way, that nickname of his, Concrete Charlie, it originated from his off-season career as a concrete salesman, not from his reputation as a ferocious tackler. Remember, back in the day, these players, even the great ones, didn't get paid very much, and they typically worked another job in the off-season. A Philly sports writer gave him the nickname Concrete Charlie, remarking that Bednarik hit as hard as the concrete he sells. The man was outspoken, to say the least, and he used colorful language for a guy who went to mass every day. But Chuck Bednarik was genuine and lovable because of it. What you saw was what you got with him. What an awesome dedication to an awesome human being. I really enjoyed that one, and his life story is just amazing. I said Bednarik was versatile and outspoken. We can make our first connection to someone who was quite versatile and outspoken to the point of profoundly insightful, but in a different career setting than professional sport. The career was as a writer, and one of the greatest, I believe personally, the greatest of the 20th century. One of my top three favorite writers of all time, the one and only George Orwell. Now, this connection came about from two avenues of convergence. The first was having on my far middle get-to list, so to speak, this topic to discuss of how Orwell had the genius to articulate and illustrate his discrete philosophical and political viewpoints into compelling fictional stories such as Animal Farm and 1984. Now, those two classics, they're great stories that have something to say, but in many ways, they're fictional illustrations of Orwell's deeper thoughts and analysis, and from his earlier non-fictional political essays and writings. It's rare to see a literary great who was able to synthesize political and philosophical arguments and observations, and then later set examples of them in play with compelling fiction to make an impactful point to a much wider audience. Orwell was a master at that, and sharing that on the far middle, I thought, would be a lot of fun. The second avenue that this connection emanated from was feedback from two constant listeners on the far middle, suggesting that I dedicate an episode to Orwell. Now, these are fellow literary fans and fellow faithful fanatics of Orwell, like me. And yeah, that's a great idea. So those two paths or avenues converged to where we are today in episode 179. What I'd like to do is discuss key Orwell essays and writings that are contrasting democracy to fascism and totalitarianism. He wrote some great pieces on the subject, and many of those takeaways that he highlighted became foundational themes of his classics, Animal Farm and 1984. So let's walk through a few of those foundational themes and see what you think. And here we go. Let's start with a few passages from his essay that was titled Fascism and Democracy. This was from early 1941. Now remember, this was during World War II for Europe, so Nazi Germany, it's fair to say, was definitely front and center on everyone's mind, including Orwell's. And he starts off with a bang in this essay by stating that one of the easiest pastimes in the world is debunking democracy. And why did both communists and fascists, who are ideologically opposed, why did they both agree on the need to and engage in attacking democracy? He found that question very interesting. And that the contention from totalitarian regimes as to why democracy is bad is that democracy is a fraud. That although an average citizen does get the chance to vote for whichever political party he or she favors, beyond election day, just about every detail of his or her life is going to be dictated by the employer. Effectively, the communist, the fascist, they're arguing that it's the elites and the moneyed class that fill all the key decision-making positions, the places of power, where decisions are made within their own hands and control. And also that the elite class can work the election and electoral system by effectively bribing the voters directly or indirectly. Now, those criticisms from, say, the communists or the fascists or the totalitarians that they used to attack democracy that Orwell cited in his essay, they're interesting when you consider them in 2024. Because today, it's not necessarily business or capitalists that are the problems, or that they're the proffered puppet masters, but it's the totalitarians who were making those criticisms back in Orwell's day that were fingering that criticism. Today, it's them that are the special interests of the elite class, and it's the bureaucrat, of course, working within and controlling the system. Things have flipped. And of course, you know, bribing the electorate through entitlements and policies and subsidies and give-outs, that continues on a scale that was unimaginable back then today. Can you say things like student debt forgiveness or wind and solar subsidy or funding, government funding media? It's everywhere you look today. And speaking of media, Orwell pointed out how critics of democracy inevitably highlight the cultural and intellectual life of a democratic society that you find through media, whether it's newspapers or books, movies, radio, whatever, that is controlled by those moneyed interests, and those money interests, they control and use that control to prevent the spread of certain ideas or thoughts or philosophies. Now, you could sort of sense how some of the themes of 1984, they were at work here in Orwell's essay. And you can see how it's ironic that those criticisms from, say, communists or the left back then are now very effective tactics used by today's version of the left to control the message of media. Orwell also highlighted another argument by totalitarians who are critics of democracy, that those who win election and hold office, who might desire to establish a different system, the example he used was injecting a level of socialism in the UK, that they would not succeed in the end of doing so because the, again, moneyed class, the elites in control, would be holding most of the permanent officials in government, along with entities like the military on their side, they would be able to resist the change. Again, interesting to think of today and the resistance movement, so to speak, that we saw within government when a certain individual who wanted to drain the swamp assumed office in 2016. Everything has indeed flipped. The totalitarians and the leftists, they adopted the playbook Orwell was summarizing back in 1941. Orwell made an excellent point, which has always been true and remains true today, I believe, which is all forms of government, democratic or totalitarian, ultimately depend on some level of force and coercion of the individual. It's just a question of degree and how much, depending on the style or type of government that you're looking at. So when critics of democracy say that liberty is a sham and nothing more than a bribe to substitute for physical force, Orwell, he pointed out that although that may be true to an extent, it is to a much lesser extent true than what you would find with, say, the tactics and the lack of individual freedoms found with fascism and communism. And on that point, he was absolutely right. Another way to summarize the difference between democracy and totalitarian government as won by degree is the example Orwell used of free speech. He pointed out that intellectual honesty is a crime in totalitarian nations, but that even in democracies such as England or the UK at the time, it's not personally profitable often to speak or write the truth. So again, it's a question of degree. Now, by the way, I should point out Orwell was what could be best described as a democratic socialist. And I'm not sure most days what that exactly means, just for the record. But he saw elements of, or a modest degree of, socialism as a good and perhaps a necessary thing for the West. But also, of course, he saw the dangers of totalitarian government and the benefits of democracy. Hey, I said I loved him as a writer. I didn't say I agreed with all of his views and political leanings. And I could say the same for another favorite of mine, John Steinbeck, who shared similar tendencies and views as that of Orwell. I just stated how Orwell wrote that speaking truth can be an unprofitable thing, even in democracies. It flows nicely into a connection to another one of Orwell's essays, this one in May 1941, titled Literature and Totalitarianism. And in this essay, Orwell observed how society was living in an age where the autonomous individual was ceasing to exist. He saw the era of free capitalism coming to an end, and one nation after another adopting a centralized economy, they would best be labeled socialism or state capitalism. And again, does any of that sound familiar today? And the key point to Orwell was that when you saw nations evolving toward these things, the natural victims that suffer, they're going to be economic liberty, the individual's ability to do what he or she likes, to choose their own line of work, and even being able to move to and from across a region, state, nation, or the world for that matter. That individual choice and freedom becomes stifled. And the individual's choice and freedom would be replaced by the state, who would run everyone's economic life in exchange for safety of society and the citizen not being afraid of poverty or unemployment. And the state would say that although the individual would lose those types of personal freedoms, he or she would still enjoy the freedom of a private intellectual life, and that art, as an example, would flourish, just like it would in a classic liberal capitalist society. Heck, a socialist or communist would argue often that art would flourish even more under their system because there would be no economic hardship experienced by the artist. They would be free to pursue their art. Orwell blows up that premise in his essay. He knew that the totalitarianism and that system of government abolishes freedom of thought so severely and to such an extent that it reaches a level of unseen sort of pain of oppression. And he also pointed out that the state's control of thought is applied not only in a negative sense, but also in a positive sense, meaning the state not only forbids you to express or to think certain thoughts, but it also dictates positively what you must think. It creates and demands an ideology that you must follow. So he saw totalitarianism as government looking to control thought and emotion of the citizens as much as and as completely as control of individual actions in the economy. And you, of course, can see how these views manifested in works like 1984. He also observed a strange aspect of the totalitarian state when it attempts to control thought. He highlighted that the state doesn't fix thought, but that it sets up unquestionable dogmas and that it alters them day by day or month by month, depending on facts and circumstances. It's really an odd thing to see. The state, on one hand, it needs the dogma because it needs obedience from the citizens, but it has to change the dogmas because the needs of power politics, they're constantly changing. And he summed this up with stating how the government or the state declares itself on one hand infallible when it's totalitarian, but on the other hand, the state attacks the very concept of objective truth. And if you heard that saying right, it's not the truth, it's your truth and it's my truth. Those are different things and that's okay. It sort of reminds me of also the famous line from Animal Farm of all animals are equal, but some animals, they're more equal than others. George wrote another essay toward the end of World War II, late 1945, and that was titled Freedom of the Park. It dealt with an incident in Hyde Park in London where police arrested individuals for distributing papers and literature in the park. Orwell saw this as a highly subjective exercise of police power, and he began to question what makes the police decide to arrest one individual rather than another. He felt the police were influenced by political considerations and that certain individuals, or more specifically, certain messages, they're going to receive more scrutiny and harsher treatment from the enforcement of law than others that are less threatening or more acceptable. Reminds me of lawfare today, where one set of rules and standards and scrutiny are applied to the favored class, an entirely different, more stringent set of standards when it comes to the laws that are applied to the disfavored. Consistency and objectivity in the law, they become lost. Orwell had a great line in this essay where he stated that the official, even when friendly to the government in power, is aware that the official himself is permanent and can frustrate more short-lived elected officials who he or she is supposed to serve and report to. And yet another parallel to the resistance against President Trump within government in 2016. The bureaucrat knows that he or she has the benefit of permanency and time on their side, and they simply wait out the elected official if it doesn't or if they don't like the marching orders that are ascribed to them. Now, Orwell saw the Hyde Park incident as proof that the level of freedom of the press and speech in democratic nations like the UK, it's often overrated. Technically, yeah, there's freedom of the press, but in reality, most of the press, it's owned by a few entities or controlled by a few people, and they use the press or media the same way that the state goes about censoring information. Mainstream media might not be interested in reporting the facts objectively as much as it might be interested in broadcasting slanted views that are favored by those who control the media. And we see that all the time these days, and that's how the notion of fake news came about. Speaking of media bias and fake news, Orwell, 1942, he publishes an essay titled Visions of a Totalitarian Future. In it, he noted that no event is ever correctly reported in the newspaper. And to a certain extent, that's always been the case, even in democracies. But then he noticed a trend occurring, particularly in totalitarian states, but also to a certain extent within democracies, whereby history was being written not in terms of what actually happened, but of what ought to have happened according to various ideologies or party lines. That worried him greatly because it gave him the sense that the very concept of objective truth was fading from the world, which meant that it was becoming possible that the lie could be transformed into the truth. And he channeled that thought straight into 1984. And of course, you see the dynamic today everywhere. When we hear of the science, right, when it comes to the left and with respect to policies and arenas as far ranging as COVID to climate change, Orwell noted, by the way, that Nazi theory specifically denies such a thing as the truth. And Nazi philosophy says that there's no such thing as science. There was only something like German science or Jewish science and so on, which sets it up to where a leader or a government can determine control of not just the future, but also the past. If the state says it never happened, well, then it never happened. And if the leader or the state says that 2 and 2 are 5, well, then 2 and 2 are indeed 5. A famous line from this essay was Orwell stating that, quote, "This prospect frightens me much more than bombs." Yeah, it frightens me too, especially in 2024. And as we close out, because we have to, episode 179 of The Far Middle, I have a special connection to make to The Final Dot. One of those essays from George Orwell appeared in October 1940. It was a couple of years after an event that shook the United States and that Orwell saw as emblematic of many of the themes he was talking about when it came to media and citizens. The event occurred around this time of year, late October, in 1938, and it was a production on CBS radio of a famous H.G. Wells story produced by the great Orson Welles. It terrified the audience because many thought it was true and a real newscast of an alien invasion. I'm speaking of the War of the Worlds broadcast. Now, Orwell wrote an essay about some of the learnings from the War of the Worlds broadcast and its follow-on effects on the public. He noted that Princeton did an assessment that estimated 6 million people heard the broadcast and that over 1 million individuals were in some degree affected by panic from the broadcast. Those numbers are sort of amazing, and it's part of the lore of the War of the Worlds broadcast that people still talk about to this day. But what was truly astonishing to Orwell was that far too few of the listeners attempted to verify or check the validity of what they were listening to. Many interpreted the play and production as a news bulletin, and a significant portion of listeners attempted no kind of verification. As soon as they heard that the end of the world was coming, they accepted it uncritically and without question. And as a side note, any parallels today that you might see to media theater scaring us into the end of the world or sort of an existential threat that you can think of? Anyway, the demographics that Princeton found most likely to be affected by that broadcast were the poor, the lesser educated, and the economically insecure. They were the most vulnerable and the most suspect to believe that what they were hearing as reality, and also potentially to panic from it. In the days after the broadcast of War of the Worlds, outrage was expressed by the media. The program's news bulletin format was described as deceptive by some newspapers and public figures. That led to an outcry and calls for regulation by the FCC. Yeah, I'm sure government regulation was the perfect cure. Orson Welles, he apologized the next morning. No punitive action was ultimately taken. The broadcast and subsequent publicity brought, believe this or not, 23-year-old Orson Welles, he was 23 at the time, brought him to the attention of the general public, gave him the reputation of an innovative storyteller, which he definitely was. Citizen Kane and the rest of his genius and his cinematic portfolio were to follow. Now, an episode that ends with George Orwell, H.G. Wells, and Orson Welles, it's got to go down as an all-time far middle grade in my book. Hope you enjoyed it. And until next week, always stay connected to that far middle.